This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Now we're going to be speaking about one government agency that at least seems to understand what it is supposed to do. Whether they're doing it as well as we expect them to do is what we're going to be deliberating on, and that is the National Youth Development Agency. And we are joined in studio by its Chief Executive Officer, Mr. Wasim Karim. You can join in this conversation on 0861-987-000 and also tweet us at PowerFM987 so we can talk about matters relating to the youth. Mr. Karim, good evening and thank you for joining us in studio.
Good evening, Kaya. Good evening to your listeners as well.
You've recently tabled your annual report in Parliament. Talk us through the highlights of the NYDA's operational year.
Yeah, thanks, Kaya. So I think 2020-2021 will always be defined by COVID. I remember sitting with you at the pre-SONA Youth Dialogue 2021. The word COVID was not in there, nor was it in the SONA. We were launching... We're opening the Presidential Youth Employment Intervention, which is President Ramaphosa's signature initiative for young people, particularly as it relates to youth unemployment. A couple of weeks later, we had the budget speech. The Minister of Finance flagged support for the program, allocating 1% of the national budget to it. And 3 weeks later, we were in hard lockdown as a country. So I think the year was pretty much defined by COVID. If we look at our revenue for the year plunged quite considerably from a high of about 550 million the previous year down to about 400 million, which an exceptional cut. The cut was used mainly to fund the COVID crisis. Broadly, I'll reflect initially on what I think government support measures to young people in the economy were, and then more specifically what the NYDA did. I think from a government perspective, if we think about the mechanisms that were instituted, probably the three largest ones was the support by the Unemployment Insurance Fund to distress businesses to keep employees employed and to provide them with some level of income provision during the crisis. Of course, the social distress of relief grant was implemented. It's initially struggled to scale, but I think we saw the importance of that, particularly in protecting many people from hunger, particularly those who work in the informal economies. And then towards the end of 2021, the first phase of the employment stimulus was introduced. 12 billion of spending was introduced in the economy. Majority of it was directed towards the Basic Employment Education Initiative, which employed about 300,000 young people as teachers' assistants and general assistants at the national minimum wage. First public employment program to reach that level of scale in a short space of time.
Yeah, and I suppose it was an important response to what the pandemic was all about. When we do talk about employment, there is this problem with government lexicon where instead of talking about jobs, they tend to add a word and they refer to them as job opportunities. Do we have an understanding of what the distinction is between a job and a job opportunity?
So I think it speaks to differences between short-term and long-term, or short-term and I'd say more sustainable job opportunities. And it also speaks to who is providing that opportunity. Is it actually being created in the economy, or is government acting as an opportunity provider through either through subsidies or incentives or actually direct public employment, right? I think the way that the stimulus in particular is being measured is we're trying to measure both jobs but livelihoods as well, right? And I think an opportunity is a job. Let's clarify that. In many cases, they are short-term in nature, but it is a job. It's somebody receiving an income, and that's how we measure a job that is created. We can debate the semantics of whether it's created by government or the private sector, but I do think you're correct in that we need to move away from measuring what we consider to be opportunities to actually measuring incomes, livelihoods, and actual jobs.
In the last quarterly labor force survey, we heard that South Africa's official unemployment rate had reached a record high of 34.4%. Young people in particular, close to three quarters of them are unemployed. And of course, that is a reflection of perhaps a longer term trajectory, which has been a pathway that we've been on as a country. And it doesn't seem to be capable of being reversed anytime soon, or at least at the same type of effort that we're putting in is not going to get us anywhere close to fixing that. What actually do we need to do to decisively deal with this particular crisis? Because I suspect if you look at the July looting, it probably reflects the sense of anxieties that exist in different sectors of society. And I imagine that if you end up with more than 80% or even 90% of young people unemployed at some point in time, those July episodes will become more frequent.
Very fair point. So I think if we reflect, South Africa has always battled an unemployment problem, right? We know that in the period where our economy grew, probably late 1990s to just before the global financial crisis, unemployment reached possibly its lowest level in South Africa's history, which was still relatively high if we compare to global standards. So I think the lowest we ever reached was 22%. Yeah? And youth unemployment was around about 32 to 34%. Yeah. Economists attribute the decline over the last decade to a number of factors, but we know particularly, and I was interested to read Michael Sacks' assessment of it, is that particularly the end of the commodity cycle just before the global financial crisis reduced the availability of resources in government to be able to allocate to spending projects. Yeah, and then he lists that as a primary factor, but then the secondary factors being the global financial crisis, load shedding, and probably a decade of poor leadership in South Africa, which has led to this economic decline. Yeah, and we've just seen this unemployment number tick up and up and up. And then COVID. I mean, COVID, the most conservative estimates indicate that about 2 million jobs were stripped from the economy during COVID. The NITS survey indicates that about 1.5 million have bounced back. Statista says about 1 million have bounced back. But even if we consider that 500,000 to 1 million, those jobs might trickle back, but some of them may be lost forever. Yeah,
and it's so tricky. And one of the issues that you mentioned is one of the factors you refer to, a decade of poor leadership. And I suspect for a lot of people, the question will be, well, has that decade ended or is it simply something that's ongoing? Because I imagine how we must distinguish between different eras of leadership is based on the achievements.
Yeah.
And I suspect that if you talk about the decade leading up to 2018 in particular, actually, since 2018, the prospects of young people in particular have not improved. So has that decade ended or is it an ongoing crisis of leadership rather than a decade of it?
Of course. So I do concur that if we look at the overall country assessment, we do not look like we're in a good position. Yeah. When we assess the performance of the sixth administration, we have to reflect on the fact that COVID has been a major inhibitor. Not that we should use it as an excuse, but it is an inhibitor.
If I even say let's discuss the stats before COVID, we'd still have the same problem though, wouldn't we?
We would, right? But it does make it difficult to measure progress, right? And I would argue that there has been progress in the last 3 years, right? Let's take simple examples, right? There is a greater level of accountability within the state sector, right? We see officials being held accountable. We see ministers being held accountable where there's underperformance and where there's poor performance, particularly as it relates to corruption, right? We do see the level of rebuilding in state institutions. Take SARS as an example, right? SARS was close to becoming a failing organization. Under Commissioner Kizwete, it really seems to be turning around, overshooting revenue estimate targets. Yeah? Take something like, and maybe the context at stage four load shedding is not proper, but we've seen a fundamental reduction in Eskom's debt burden, for example, right?
Terrible example.
So I'm saying there is examples of progress, right? Take the youth unemployment problem. And I argue again that measurement is difficult because we have to measure pre-COVID and we have to measure post-COVID. But the president and the presidency has aggregated spending of between 11 to 12 billion for the last 2 years on youth employment programs, right? We can argue the semantics of direct public employment versus the economy needing to grow. But the political will to mobilize that level of funding was not in existence in the previous decade. I can account for that as the CEO of NYDA, you know. So the political will to try and transform the lives of young people while we wait for this economic growth that we need. And we must also recognize that the IMF and the World Bank have ticked up our economic growth prospects for the future. So they are what probably the Minister of Finance likes to refer to as green shoots. Are there problems? There are fundamental problems in South Africa. Does that mean anything is being done? A lot is being done. Yeah. And I think we have to rally behind the programs that are there in the political economy at the moment to try and transform the lives of young people.
again, I suppose the difficulty here is that whilst we may cite a few examples of what we may refer to as progress, the litmus test for the effectiveness and the success of those programs is whether it actually makes a dent in the unemployment indicators, particularly for young people. So for a young person who was not employed throughout that particular decade, whenever it ended, for a young person who's lost a job during the pandemic, for them, the key question here is what exactly is the master plan that translates to them being able to transition back into the job market sometime soon? Does the government have a blueprint to what needs to be done?
So if we look at the Economic Recovery and Reconstruction Plan, it looks at the macro factors that South Africa needs to achieve: energy security, supply, economic growth, foreign direct investment, more investor confidence in the economy, the stuff we know about, right? But we always acknowledge that young people cannot necessarily wait for that fundamental change in the economy. Now, if for the last 2 years we have delivered at scale programs which support at a level of 11 billion or 12 billion, support close to 600,000 jobs and livelihood opportunities, primarily for young people. Yeah. The question for us as we move into the cycle for 2022, 2023 is, what number can we potentially target? If 12 billion delivers 600,000 opportunities for young people, how do we get that number up to 2.4, 2.5 million, right? Because then I feel like you really start to make a dent in unemployment. If you create 2.5 million jobs, livelihood opportunities, you bring down the unemployment percentage by a full 25%. That means you bring down unemployment from 30% to around about 24, 25%. So things start looking up a little bit. And how do you do that over the medium-term expenditure framework? That kind of spending, when it's efficient and when it's delivered without corruption, means that not only are you spending on a young person and putting money into their pockets, you're putting money into local economies, benefiting the small businesses that live there. You're stimulating aggregate demand, right? And I also think that because our unemployment problem is so big in South Africa, if you're going to try and say 10 million over the next year, you're never going to be able to achieve it, right? But you set yourself a more realistic target to say the private sector incentivized working together with the public sector. If we can deliver 2 million, if we can do 25% of the unemployment number, and we do it at household level. So we say that if we look at every household that has no members employed, right, and we put one job in every one of those households, I can guarantee you, you'll start improving household outcomes, right? So if there's a person who's employed and they have a brother or sister, suddenly they create a network for them, to be able to access an opportunity. Suddenly there's more income in the household, so educational outcomes start to improve, And if you look at it at that level, I think you start to see potential for change in the economy. Where I think we may be falling short, and where I think we need to think a little bit out of the box, is how we think about the national budget. We definitely need to raise revenues a little bit to be able to fund these kind of programs, right? Or at least create these incentives for the private sector to jump onto these kind of programs. And I think where South Africa is at the moment, I don't think we're using the benefits of the commodity cycle to full effect. Because I do think that money can be better directed for spending in the economy.
Well, you know, when we talk about these structural solutions that need to be implemented, again, the evidence sits in front of us that it says that within the dimension of young people in particular, your chances of being unemployed are close to 75%. That is the overall number. However, if you're a graduate, that suddenly collapses to just 11%. So the prospects of you getting into the workplace once you have some form of post-secondary qualification is much higher. So here's one potential answer that says, well, maybe if you get many more people to play within that 11% gamble rather than the 80% gamble, then you actually do fix this in the long term. Has the government done anything to actually capitalize on the fact that actually education seems to be one of the great enablers?
Yes, of course it does, right? So again, if we assess performance over time, one of the potential sources of progress has been high education to young people, right? So you look at what TEFSA was funding in 1994, about 6,000 students a year, and what NASFAS has scaled to anywhere between 600,000 to 800,000 students supported on an annual basis, right? And the level of return on investment that provides to the economy, but also the social mobility, right? If there's one success story, it has been young Black professionals rising up into the middle class and upper middle class in South Africa, The tragedy often is that of every NASFA student that we fund, only one out of two actually goes on to graduation. Yeah? And I think you've always made the point is that you can't regard a second or third year engineering student who may not have completed the same as a person who just has matric, right?
Yep.
So I think where the Department of Higher Education probably needs to play a bigger role is where students are close to completing and have issues of historical debt, I think the government can act as a contingency for that debt at universities and allow those students to graduate, because I think there are opportunities for them to find immediate placement in the economy are there and become part of the tax base, and we know the benefits that that provides. Let me just give you one example of the stimulus as well. We battled this increasing issue of unemployed graduates in South Africa. Of the unemployed graduates who were employed as part of the stimulus to assist with assessing small-scale agricultural farmers' applications, because of that small level of work experience that they got, the majority of them were able to move on and become permanently employed in the economy, right? How I think we need to look at it, Kaya, is to say, are we able to put millions of young people through a three-year tertiary qualification or even a full-year qualification? I don't think we can, right? But what we can do is train for actual demand in the economy. Let's look at sectors which are actually growing, right? Global business services and digital skills. South Africa ranks only behind India in the global business services sector. And we've seen a lot of collaboration between private sector and public sector there. Right now, we could fill 60,000 digital economy jobs in the economy immediately, right? But it has to reform the way we do things. Yeah. Mm. What we're piloting is a pay-for-performance model, because I also argue that I think the largest beneficiaries of CETA funding and training funding in South Africa have not been young people, but have been with the private training providers. So if you shift the obligation on training providers not to train, but to train for actual demand and train for placement, you create a much more sustainable form of spending of government here. And you link young people on shorter, non-accredited courses to actual demand that's required.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier on that under this administration, there is perhaps a renewed or a greater appetite to support all of these initiatives that you know, are aimed at, you know, improving the prospects of young people. But as you speak now, we're speaking about all the things that ought to be done, that can be done. So again, it looks like we're speculating and out of thought that if this administration's commitment to the cause is as strong as you say it is, we wouldn't be speculating about these things. We'd be talking about the implementation thereof.
Well, I think we can refer to implementation, right? The basic education initiative, the recruitment for the second phase started again in October, right? Yeah. Close to 1 million young people applied for those jobs. And from the 1st of November, 280,000 of them will be placed in those jobs. They'll earn at the national minimum wage right up to March 2021. And as NYDA and the presidency, we will lobby hard that that program becomes part of the medium-term expenditure framework. So at scale, we've taken young people out of unemployment, placed them, and I just want you to reflect on this: the reach of that program. South Africa has 26,000 public schools. That program reaches almost every single community in the country. Yeah. Next week, I'll be chatting to you about National Youth Service, and I don't want to say too much about that. The National Skills Fund will be putting out exactly what we've spoken about, a paper for performance model for exactly the skills that we've spoken about. Yeah. So if you look at, across the stimulus that Minister Gungubele opened last week, you'll see a multitude of programs, yeah, that are there for young people to be able to access. Yeah. So I do think that the problem is big, but we're tackling it one piece at a time.
Okay, Wasim, we do have a caller for you, Katlego from Kagiso. Good evening to you.
Good evening. How are you, Kaya?
All good, brother.
I'm good. Listen, man, I just want to ask the CEO something. You get a situation where, like, you've got a company, let's say, of three people. Yeah? Two of them are younger than 35, and one is just over the 35. And then NYTA decides that they're not going to be able to assist this company because of this one director who is over 35, which disenfranchise the two others who are under 35. I don't understand why is that, you know? Why don't we take into account those that are under 35 who are part of the company?
Yeah.
You know, how are we then growing this economy if you are disenfranchising others because of one person who is just over the age of 35?
Okay, thank you very much. That was Katlego from Kagiso. Sounds like there's a blanket approach. You say that as soon as somebody says happy birthday and you're 35, they immediately get excluded from all systems of support.
I would, Katlego would see my inbox of young people who are angry that I shouldn't be assisting older people. Yeah, look, it's been a debate for a long time. I'll be honest with you in saying that the legislation that governs the NYD doesn't allow me to be able to fund anybody who is over the age of 35. Yeah, and that legislative framework is something that we do take seriously as the organization. For me, it's never been about rejecting young people who may in the majority be part of a business, right? And that's why I've always said that the NYD doesn't exist in a silo. Yeah. Where possible, I've also tried to locate our regional centers close to other centers of government. So where, for example, those issues come to our attention, we refer those young people to the CFR office, which is often right next to us, yeah, which provide a very similar service to the NYDA, but can do it for matters that fall out of our legislative mandate. So at no point should any young person be turned away from an NYDA office. For us, it's about referring those young people so that they find assistance in another sector of government.
You mentioned the many emails that you receive in your inbox, and of course, part of the reason you probably can't assist, besides the legal age requirement or limitation, is a question of resources itself.
Yeah.
Is the NDA fully capacitated to even deal with whatever mandate you have currently?
Yeah, so I mean, look, I think for us, a big issue has been the funding constraint. You know, when I became the CEO and even my predecessor before, we looked at the landscape of where the NYDA is. And, you know, the NYDA has a rough history associated with it, right? And what I said to the management team and the staff at large is that nobody's just going to fund you because you say they must fund you. Yeah, the only time people will fund you is if you can create value. You create value for your stakeholders. You create value for young people. Yeah. Now I'm proud to say that the NYDA, from being an agency which is funded at about 450 million, has grown in excess of R1 billion now, right? Post-COVID, yeah. Which means the National Treasury, the Presidency, and numerous other stakeholders find us to be an investable organization. That, again, allows us to scale the numbers that we're doing into the higher 10,000s and 20,000s and allows us to be able to reach more young people. The NYD is not a silo. Yeah? Can it solve every problem of young person in South Africa? It cannot, right? But it should be a focal point for young people. As far as possible, we should be able to refer young people either to other sectors of government, the private sector, so that in some meaningful way we improve that. And many young people, believe it or not, they don't require funding. They don't require a job. Some of them just need a pathway. Some of them just want to volunteer over the weekends so they can gain experience. And that's really what we're trying to set the NYDA up to be. But I do believe we're a growing organization. I believe our impact is increasing. I believe we have the support of a number of other stakeholders. Yeah, and you do the best you can in the space you have. If you try and solve every problem, you're never going to get there. I think that's what strategy is about. It's picking your problems and doing the best you can in them.
A very tricky one. Young people are probably trying to make the call on whether to vote and who to vote for next week. If a young person is looking at the state of the economy and their state of their exclusion, what are the hopes that they have over the next year or two?
So let's talk about the voting question for just one second, right? And I wrote a piece of this in the media a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, is that so? It's easy to jump to say there's voter apathy in South Africa, right? So for at one level, let's take that out of the equation for one second. Yeah, is that South Africa's voting stats for young people don't differ to mature democracies like the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada. Yeah, we 65% of young people in all those democracies don't vote. Mm. So it's a fact that as we mature, we become more engaged in political processes and we're more likely to vote. Yeah. Secondly, in the United States, biggest high voter turnout in 2020, mostly driven by the fact that it was easier to vote. Mail-in ballots, electronic voting systems. I've made some recommendations, or we've made some recommendations to the IEC. When you get your first ID book, why are you not registered to vote then?
Mm.
When you register for SRC elections, why are you not registered to vote then? Right? Let's make registration processes easier, and I think you'll see better voter turnout. Yeah? Mm. Two, yes, we cannot discount the socioeconomic conditions of young people from the voter apathy conversation. Yeah,
yeah.
We are doing our best. Yeah, in the physical situation that we find ourselves, we're doing our best to scale the number of opportunities, to put income in the hands of young people. But I also think, Kaya, We must never reduce youth development to youth unemployment conversation. Youth development is much broader. And when we start focusing on the development of young people as they transition through different phases of life, and we focus more on the development, we'll see better youth unemployment outcomes.
Definitely hoping to see some progress. Unfortunately, we're completely out of time. Thank you for joining us. Mr. Wasim Karim is the Chief Executive Officer of the National Youth Development Agency. We are going to have you back next week on a follow-up conversation relating to some of the solutions for young people.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.